Getting Better, Inside Alcoholics Anonymous by Nan Robertson. Chapter 1, The Journey. In the winter of 1987, I went back to the elegant drunk tank in Manhattan where I'd gotten sober for good. I saw the woman I had been 11 years before. I saw truly and for the first time what alcohol had made of me. I saw what I had done to myself. It was the patients fresh from the bottle who held the mirror up to me and what they said and did and how they looked. I remembered Nan, the Nan of November 1975. I'd come there with some shine and sparkle left on the surface. Inside I was empty, a self-deluding, frightened, successful, charming, pathetic fraud. In that place, the rehabilitation unit of the Smithers Alcoholism Center, I began the search for the Nan that I hoped would still be there, somewhere in the void, and for something better. It took years to find me. It will take all the time I have left. But Smithers began the process, and Alcoholics Anonymous is continuing it to this day. I was expected to spend Thanksgiving of 1975 with my mother at home in Illinois, but I would not complete my 28-day treatment inside Smithers until early December. I had planned to tell her that I was being sent on an assignment elsewhere in the country. It is easy to make such social excuses if you're a newspaper reporter, but my counselor and my therapy group of Smithers patients were adamant. "You are finally getting honest with yourself and others," they said. "You cannot lie to your mother." "But she's 83 years old," I pleaded. "I can't say I'm an alcoholic. This will kill her." "For Christ's sake," said a longshoreman in the group, "so don't tell her you're an alcoholic. Tell her you're a problem drinker." I went sweating with apprehension to the phone. I told Mother I could not come home for Thanksgiving. Oozing counterfeit charm, I went on, "Oh, Mother, I'm in the most wonderful place with the most wonderful people. There are stockbrokers here from Yale and welfare mothers and accountants like yourself, and..." My mother came back like a shot. "Is that a place for alcoholics?" "Well, Mother," I said, "well, yes, there are some problem drinkers among us, and..." "Oh, Nan, darling," my mother said, "you've made me so happy. I've worried about your drinking for years." Tears came to my eyes. I have never loved my mother more. Time passed. I got better one day at a time, first at Smithers, then in Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes I got worse. I kept going to AA meetings. I saw wrecks turning back into human beings and rejoiced in their recovery and mine. And then one day in 1983, with 8 years in AA and more than 1,000 meetings behind me across the United States and abroad, I went to Bedford Hills, New York, to see Lois Wilson. Lois, then in her early 90s, was the living link to the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, her husband Bill Wilson. She had seen AA grow from 2 men in 1935 to almost 2 million men and women around the world in the 1980s. She herself was the co-founder of the Al-Anon movement for the families of alcoholics, which had begun as an auxiliary only for the wives of men sober in AA and had grown to an international organization of 500,000 members. She welcomed me, and I began to tell her why I had come. "I want to write a book that gives an inside view of Alcoholics Anonymous," I blurted out. "I want to demystify it. I wanted to pull it all together," I said, "to write not just the lives of Bill and Dr. Bob, Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, the other founder, and the early years in AA, but what it's like today and how AA works and perhaps why it works, if I could. Nobody," I said, "has really told outsiders before what part religion plays and does not play in AA, which I think is the biggest misconception people have about us. Some people think we're a bunch of religious nuts." By this time, Lois was nodding her head. I rushed on. I told her I wanted to bring readers inside AA meetings to show them what goes on there, to try to portray the foxhole humor as well as the drama that knits members together. Lois looked at me sharply. "Are you going to write this book under your full name?" I said, "Yes." "Are you going to say you're a member of AA?" she asked. I told her that I thought the book would be much more authentic and believable if I revealed that I was in AA. I said that everybody else in AA I wrote about would be protected. Lois frowned. She reminded me that the 11th AA tradition warns against breaking even one's own anonymity at the public level in print or broadcast. No wonder she remembered. Her husband wrote it. We fell into an uncomfortable silence. Then Lois smiled. She said, it's high time for such a book. With that conversation, my journey began. For the next 3.5 years, I crisscrossed the United States, where half of all the members of Alcoholics Anonymous live. There was a detour to Mexico, which has the biggest AA contingent outside the U.S. I went back to AA's roots in Akron, Ohio, the city where Bill Wilson met Dr. Bob. I talked to AA old-timers everywhere who remembered what it was like in the 1930s when AA was a secret little band of shakily sobered-up drunks. I saw the AA of today, the 3,000 recovered alcoholics festively dressed who attended the annual Bill Wilson banquet at the New York Hilton, having an uproarious time on nothing stronger than Coca-Cola. I saw the 44,000 members who streamed into Montreal from all over the world in July 1985 to celebrate the 50th birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the biggest convention the city had ever seen and the best behaved. I traveled empty stretches of the American West where members had to cope with the fact that the closest town and AA meeting were 2 hours' drive away. At 4 o'clock one morning, I sat in an isolated ranch house as a woman put on tape cassettes to hear alcoholics tell their stories at meetings in far-off places. She subscribed to one of the underground tape services that specializes in recording AA meetings all over the country. Members exchange favorite tapes with a relish that recalls little kids swapping comic books. Laughter rolled off these tapes, the laughter of people who knew every delusion, every dodge. It is a sound that echoes throughout AA. Understanding laughter. Snapshots from my journey. Mexico City. It was Christmas time. Pinwheels, stars, candles, and Feliz Navidad signs flashed red, blue, green, and yellow from the ancient arcaded buildings. Streams of cars zoomed around the Zocalo, the gargantuan central square. Filling the north end was the cathedral. Beggars and peddlers accosted passersby. Inside, a wedding mass being celebrated. I had been told that an AA meeting was held here every Wednesday evening. I tried every side door, looking in vain for an AA sign on the doorknobs, the walls. I went out and around to the back, stumbling over rough pavement in darkness the blazing Zocalo did not penetrate. Above me there was one lighted window, illuminating a tiny hand-painted placard that said, AA. Ahead was an open door where the cathedral group of AA met. I was early. Pictures of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob hung on the wall. There were AA slogans in Spanish and another welcoming sign, Here we love each other, believe in each other, hope for each other. People wandered in and said, Hola, with hugs and thumps on the back. The atmosphere was noisy, merry, like a cantina bar. Mi nombre es Nan. Soy de Nueva York y soy alcoholica, I said, and they embraced me and pressed my hands with both of theirs. The meeting began. I realized I was the only woman in a room full of dark, vivid, callous-palmed men. The evidence in flesh of the statistics that Alcoholicos Anonymous in Mexico, with 250,000 members, is overwhelmingly male and working class. Each man stepped to the lectern and told of the terrible things he had done in his drinking life to his wife, his sainted mother, his daughters. Each spoke of the beauty of today. Each gazed at me as he spoke. I felt like the Virgin of Guadalupe. Rancho Mirage, California. Driving to the top of a wrinkled mountain range, purple in the morning light. Below lay Palm Springs, Palm Desert, Rancho Mirage. Fountains, bright flowers, lawns like putting greens in the midst of a hostile desert. Bob Hope Drive crossed streets named after Frank Sinatra and Dinah Shore. AA groups outnumbered the golf courses 2 to 1, 50 of them, meeting weekly. They were named Early Birds, Candlelight Beginners. Dolls of the Valley, a popular women's group, gathered every Wednesday. I sat with Betty Ford, the wife of the 38th President of the United States, a recovering pill addict and alcoholic in the soothing beige and pink interior of the intensive rehabilitation center named after her. She's a vital part of that center, inspiring patients by her own steadfastness and honesty. Just before her 60th birthday in April 1978, her children and her husband Gerald Ford, only 14 months out of the White House, confronted her. With them was Dr. Joseph Pirsch, then head of the Long Beach Naval Hospital's Alcohol and Drug Rehabilitation Service. He had carefully rehearsed the family, all its members armed with written lists detailing specific instances of Mrs. Ford's drugged behavior as each had experienced it. Mrs. Ford collapsed in a storm of weeping and shock, but she said she had enough sense left to realize her family was doing this because they loved her and wanted to help. She entered the Long Beach Hospital for treatment and issued a statement to a stunned nation. She confessed to over-medicating herself. She could admit to the pills prescribed for arthritis, a pinched nerve, muscle spasms in her neck. After all, the doctors had done it to her. She could not face the alcoholism because that meant she had done it to herself. Finally, after further treatment at Long Beach, with her husband's assurance that it would not embarrass him, she issued another statement. "I have found that I am not only addicted to the medications I have been taking for my arthritis, but also to alcohol. I expect this treatment and fellowship to be a solution for my problem, and I embrace it not only for me, but for all the others who are here to participate. I said to Mrs. Ford that it was hard enough for ordinary people to confess they are drunks and then set about to rebuild their lives. What must it have been like for a president's wife?" She replied, "I never could have found recovery if I thought myself to be in a special place. I am just another recovering woman." Kent, Connecticut, New Year's Eve. A faded peeling sign pointed up a steep hill 4 miles north of Kent, a New England hamlet on Connecticut's western edge. "High Watch," the sign said. A plain 18th century farmhouse painted white, a scattering of red clabbered outbuildings. "In the old days," said Tom S., the manager, a recovered alcoholic like everyone on the staff, "they used to trundle the drunks with the DTs in a wheelbarrow to the farthermost shack. We called it the leper colony." This was High Watch Farm, the oldest retreat and rest house based on AA principles. High Watch was a continent and a world away from the glamorous Rancho Mirage. Everyone pitched in, to vacuum the hook rugs, clear and set tables, wash dishes, stack chairs. High Watch was founded in 1939, the year Alcoholics Anonymous got its name. Bill Wilson came here many times, Tom said. He talked about AA. He sat in that chair. It sends chills up my spine. I spent New Year's Eve and New Year's Day and the second day of 1987 at High Watch with my own kind, alcoholics, all of us. It seemed the best place to be quiet, to think back on a long journey, to thank God as I do every day for my life. Chapter 2. Two Men. Bill Wilson was dying for a drink. It was a Saturday in May 1935, and as he paced the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, he was gripped by a frenzy of longing, away from his home and his wife, alone at the end of yet another doomed business venture. Wilson was a Wall Street hustler, a margin trader with grand dreams who had failed at every job he had ever had. He was 39 years old. He was a recently sobered-up drunk. Only months before, he had been panhandling on the streets, stealing from his wife's purse, falling downstairs, lying in his own vomit, accosting strangers in the New York subway to tell them that religion was pious shit. His wife, Lois, the steady breadwinner during 17 years of marriage, had been reaching the end of her patience as he entered the drying-out hospital in Manhattan for the fourth time. He had been discharged in December of 1934. For 5 months, he had managed to stay sober by helping other drunks and attending meetings of the Oxford Group, an international movement that preached a return to the simple faith of the earliest Christians. In the hospital one day, Wilson experienced an overwhelming religious exaltation that might have been the result of hallucinations during his withdrawal from alcohol. Whatever it was, he came out of it believing in God for the first time and thinking that there was hope for his condition. He soon became obsessed with helping other drunks. Working with them during the months that followed his last hospital stay convinced him that what he needed to do to keep from drinking was to talk to another drunk. He fled the sound of laughter from the hotel bar and went to the church directory in the lobby, seeking a clergyman who might be in the Oxford group. The clergyman could not see Bill right away, but gave him the numbers of 10 additional Oxford group members in Akron. They all had other plans. He was becoming frantic. The last man suggested Wilson call Henrietta Sieberling. Wilson's first words to her were, "I'm from the Oxford Group, and I'm a rum hound from New York." Henrietta Sieberling was not an alcoholic, but she was an enthusiastic member of the Oxford Group. She was a Vassar graduate. She had married a son of Frank A. Sieberling, the founder and first president of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, but he had abandoned her and their three children. At a meeting 2 years before, she had met Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith and his wife Anne. She had grown to love them, but she was worried sick about Dr. Smith's drinking, his slipping medical practice, the snickers behind his back. He was a proctologist and rectal surgeon, and now his colleagues were saying, "When you go to Dr. Smith, you really bet your ass." When Henrietta got the telephone call from the New Yorker who said he needed to talk to another drunk in order to preserve his own shaky sobriety, her first thought was, "This is like manna from heaven." Acting on an inspired hunch, she said to the stranger, "You come right out here." Her thought was to bring Bill Wilson and Bob Smith together. When the tall, awkward Wilson slouched over her doorstep that Saturday and proceeded to put his feet up on her furniture, Henrietta was appalled. She found him both vulgar and servile with a smarmy grin. He was loud and garrulous. She disliked him on sight. Nonetheless, Henrietta saw in this lout the savior of Dr. Smith. That afternoon, she phoned the Smiths to invite them to dinner to meet him. The doctor was drunk, passed out on his bed. The Smiths could not come. Henrietta called the Smiths again the next day. "Will Bob be able to make it today?" Dr. Smith was suffering from a shattering hangover and was reluctant to go. On the way, he extracted a promise from Anne that they would not stay more than 15 minutes. They spent 6 hours together, most of it alone. The meeting between the two men, who became the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, set a pattern that has since been followed by millions of drunks desperate to be well, because the essence of the process is one person telling his story to another as honestly as he knows how. Bill Wilson and Bob Smith were dramatically different in many ways. Wilson was a name-dropper who sought out friends among the rich and super-achieving and was fascinated by success, money, and power. Quite an irony for the founder of an organization that shuns all three. He was uncomfortable with the unadorned truth and felt compelled to embroider it. His moods could swing violently. He suffered crippling bouts of depression. Wilson's marriage to Lois Burnham in 1918 lasted until his death at the age of 75 in 1971. She believed in him fiercely, yet he was a compulsive womanizer. His flirtations and his adulterous behavior filled him with guilt, but he continued to stray. His most serious love affair with a woman at AA headquarters in New York began when he was in his 60s. This affair and experiments in spiritualism, LSD, and megavitamin therapy scandalized AA trustees. But his qualities of generosity, openness to change, and humility about his own shortcomings were particularly endearing. "I never heard him bitch about anybody," said a man who joined AA in the 1940s and was one of its first homosexual members. "It wouldn't have mattered if I was a cannibal." From the time of their marriage in 1918 through Bill's catastrophic drinking years in the late 1920s and early 1930s and beyond into sobriety, Lois was her husband's confidant and nurse, his decision-maker, and financial support. If she knew of Bill's infidelities, it did not seem to affect her devotion. "She never mentioned his philandering," said one of Lois's oldest friends. "It would have offended her sense of dignity, of the rightness, the appropriateness of things." Dr. Bob, as he has always been called by AA members, is a more shadowy figure than Bill Wilson, partly because he died when AA was only 15 years old in 1950. Understated, unflappable, a man of few words, he avoided the limelight. He was a dignified man, gallant to women, yet had a slangy way of speaking about them. He relished a dirty joke in the company of men. He was a steady hand that held the cord of Wilson's high-flying, erratic kite. Conventional and sometimes dogmatic, Dr. Bob opposed the admission of women alcoholics into the initially all-male AA. In those days, nice women were not supposed to be drunks. He died at the age of 71. Unlike Dr. Bob, Bill traveled widely and spoke often. Bill wrote the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. the uniquely effective system of recovery from alcoholism and approach to a life of quality. His four books, beginning in 1939 with Alcoholics Anonymous, which gave the movement its name and is called the Big Book by members, preserved his ideas and the experiences common to many alcoholics. He also wrote hundreds of articles, most of them for the AA Grapevine, a monthly magazine. The six-hour meeting between Bill and Dr. Bob at Henrietta's house changed all of them forever. Bill moved into the Smith's house for the summer. The invitation came at a perfect time. Bill was almost broke. He wrote to Lois back in New York that he was working to change a new friend and that he was living with them so that each man could keep an eye on the other. Then Dr. Bob went on his last long binge at the American Medical Association convention in Atlantic City. The sobering up process took 3 days. Dr. Bob had an operation scheduled for that third day. Bill spent the interval loading the doctor up with fortifiers, sauerkraut and tomato juice for vitamins, and Caro corn syrup for energy. That was a theory we had, and gave him a few beers to steady his nerves and taper him off. On the way to City Hospital the morning of the operation, June 10, 1935, Dr. Bob still had the shakes. Bill gave him another bottle of beer. Alcoholics Anonymous dates its beginning from that day, the day of Bob Smith's last drink. He telephoned Ann and Bill hours later to tell them the operation had been successful. Chapter 3, The Early Christians. In the beginning, the tiny band of AA pioneers was simply stumbling ahead, day after perilous day, into a way of life without drinking. "We were groping in the dark," Dr. Bob said. "I, a physician, knew nothing about alcoholism to speak of. There wasn't anything worth reading in any of the textbooks. Usually the information consisted of some queer treatment for the DTs if the patient had gone that far. If he hadn't, you prescribed a few bromides and gave the fellow a good lecture." AA's founding members were ignorant of the past. They had no idea that in this country the concept of alcoholism as a disease went back to the dawn of the American Republic. Dr. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, a Philadelphian who was the most respected physician of his time, was the first American to call chronic drunkenness a distinct, progressive disease. His argument that drunkenness was the fault of the drinker only in the early stages of that disease, before alcohol took total command, was a radical departure from previous thinking. It became a classic in temperance literature. Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob knew nothing of Dr. Rush. They'd never heard of the Washingtonians, the 19th century group that AA came most to resemble, which swelled from 6 drunks meeting in Baltimore in 1840 to 150,000 before the end of the decade. Opposed by the clergy and other temperance movements, the Washingtonians shriveled away by the Civil War. Bill and Dr. Bob were aware only that the temperance crusaders had reached their pinnacle with the passage of national prohibition. It ended in failure. The law was in force from early 1920 through 1933, years when both men had plunged into a quagmire of mindless, helpless binging. The two founders of AA slowly and painfully discovered that it took the experience and determination of one alcoholic to help another. They also had the support of the Oxford Group. Its importance in shaping AA concepts cannot be overstated. The core of the Oxford program, adapted by AA, included unconditional surrender of the human will to the will of God, taking a personal moral inventory, confessing, sharing, before other members, making amends to people whom a member had harmed, and working with others who needed help, willingly and without thought of financial reward. The small cluster of drunks struggling to get sober within Akron's Oxford group in the summer of 1935 also turned to the Bible for solace. Another favorite of Bill and Dr. Bob was The Varieties of Religious Experience, a study in human nature by William James, the great American psychologist and philosopher. It is the only source given credit in Wilson's lasting volume, Alcoholics Anonymous, The Big Book. James's view of God was not Christian. He was not interested in religious institutions. He believed in believing and in man's personal experience of some power higher than himself. From Varieties, Bill extracted 3 other ideas that became central to AA thought. First, Change came when a person reached a state of total desperation and collapse. Second was an admission of defeat. Third was an appeal to a higher power, or at least a cry for help to another human being. This might or might not be a religious experience. It could be a lightning flash of exaltation and a lifting of a burden, as in Bill's case, or a slow and steady transformation into a state of peace and comfort within oneself, as happened with Dr. Bob and most members of AA. Beginning in 1935, Dr. Bob became an extraordinarily effective worker with active alcoholics. He was tough. He was inflexible. He told his prospects, "Do you want to surrender to God? Take it or leave it." Soon carloads of drunks were coming to Akron from as far away as Cleveland to meet in Dr. Bob's house. The young were not welcome then. The feeling was they had not suffered enough, had not lived enough years and lost enough to hit bottom. Women alcoholics were not welcome either, but non-alcoholic wives were brought into the picture from the beginning and usually attended meetings. A wife recalled, "Many a time Joe and I dropped in on Dr. Bob and Ann for a potluck meal. We might have bread and milk for supper. There were no apologies. Everybody was honest and genuine. With so many people at the table, we might have 11 kinds of potato salad because we were all too poor to buy wieners. I wonder if AAs today appreciate how pitifully poor most of us were in those early struggling days." On August 26, 1935, Bill returned home to Brooklyn. He had never been so content. In Dr. Bob, he had found a friend and brother for life. He was enthusiastic about the work with other alcoholics in Akron. He had come back to the warmth of an Oxford group welcome in New York. But he did not know that Lois was stifling a growing resentment, a common feeling among the spouses of alcoholics who have stopped drinking. One Sunday, Bill casually said to his wife, "We'll have to hurry or we'll be late for the Oxford group meeting." Lois exploded. She threw a shoe at him. "Damn your old meetings," she shouted. It took her years to figure out why she was so angry. Much later, she confessed, "After Bill sobered up, it was a great blow for me to realize that he did not need me in the way he had before. My primary aim in life, helping Bill achieve sobriety, had been canceled out, and I had not yet found anything to take its place. Slowly I recognized that because I had not been able to cure Bill of his alcoholism, I resented the fact that someone else had done so, and I was jealous of his newfound friends. My ego had been nourished during his drinking years by the important roles I had to fill, mother, nurse, breadwinner, decision maker. I also saw that I had been self-righteous and smug, thinking that I was doing for Bill all that any wife could do. God, through the Oxford group, had accomplished in a twinkling what I had failed to do in 17 years. That fall, the Wilsons followed the example of the Smiths by making their home a halfway house for drunks. When I think back in those days, I wonder what we lived on, Lois said. The long-suffering Lois was losing her temper more frequently. She was resentful that her husband didn't have time for her anymore. "The house was full of drunks. You were always out working on somebody and bringing somebody home," she told Bill years later. She loved the house. She had been raised there. It was 4 stories tall, with steep steps leading up to the front door on the parlor floor. Marble Victorian fireplaces and high-carved ceilings gave it an elegant air. Into this setting came Bill's sloppy alcoholic friends, demanding more pancakes for breakfast, stashing empty whiskey bottles in the kitchen where Lois, seething, found them. Unlike Dr. Bob in Akron, Bill had almost no long-term success in sobering up alcoholics. Most of them got drunk again repeatedly. One, a lawyer, committed suicide. The Wilsons were away visiting friends. They returned to find him dead and to discover that he had also pawned some of their clothes. By 1937, Bill and Dr. Bob could count only 40 alcoholics between them who were staying dry as a result of their example. But Bill reasoned that the number of alcoholics in the world who wanted to get well was reckoned in millions. A book could carry the message about their little society. Bill began work on the book Alcoholics Anonymous in the spring of 1938. According to Lois, Bill wrote the first draft of the steps in one night in their bed. That first draft of the 12 steps was very close to its final version, which read, 1. we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. The first copies of Alcoholics Anonymous rolled off the Cornwall Press in Cornwall, New York, in April 1939. The plant's owner, Edward Blackwell, agreed to print the book and accept $500 as down payment. All the alcoholics could scrape together. They chose the thickest paper in Blackwell's plant. The first edition was so bulky that it quickly became known as the Big Book. The initial reaction of the medical profession was one of contempt. A review in the Journal of the American Medical Association for October 14, 1939, called Alcoholics Anonymous a curious combination of organizing propaganda and religious exhortation. The one valid thing in the book is the recognition of the seriousness of addiction to alcohol. Other than this, the book has no scientific merit or interest. Earlier, the New York Times had been more charitable. In June 1939, a Sunday Times reviewer wrote, "The general thesis of Alcoholics Anonymous is more soundly based psychologically than any other treatment of the subject I have ever come upon." The Reverend Harry Emerson Fosdick of New York's Riverside Church threw his enormous prestige solidly behind the book. His review, which appeared in religious publications, declared, "This extraordinary book deserves the careful attention of anyone interested in the problem of alcohol, whether as victims, friends of victims, physicians, clergymen, psychiatrists, or social workers. This book will give them, as no other treatise known to this reviewer will, an inside view of the problem which the alcoholic faces. Only one who has been an alcoholic and has escaped the thraldom can interpret the experience." Despite the reviews, nearly all the initial 5,000 copies of Alcoholics Anonymous remained in Edward Blackwell's warehouse. In the spring of 1939, Bill and Lois were forced to leave her family's home. The bank holding the mortgage had finally sold the house, for which the Wilsons had been paying a minuscule rent since Lois's father died in 1936. For the next 2 years, they lived like vagabonds, first with one AA family, then with another. There were some bright spots. Liberty Magazine, one of the most popular periodicals of the time, published an approving article called "Alcoholics and God" in September 1939. The title made Bill nervous. The next month, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, a strong Midwest daily, published a 7-part series on AA, backed up with supportive editorials. Recruits began coming in, but it was a trickle compared to Bill's hopes. It was not until 2 years later that AA got the breakthrough it had been waiting for. A cover article in the Saturday Evening Post, the weekly magazine that more than 3 million Americans read and believed in. The piece was intelligent, riveting, understandable. The most famous single article in AA history, published March 1, 1941, it was thought to be the main reason the membership quadrupled that year from 2,000 to 8,000. In 1940, the New York members, weary of wandering from home to home for their gatherings, finally found their first meeting center in a former stable on West 24th Street. Lois and Bill lived upstairs. A member described the clubhouse atmosphere. People came from everywhere, driving in from Connecticut or Westchester or just drifting in from the streets of Manhattan. If you came early, you sat on chairs in the sitting room or on the stairs to the second floor. There was a picture of Bill above the fireplace with what looked like a halo around his head. We used to kid Bill about it. There were no young people. There were many more men than women, and all of them had been low-bottom drunks. I wasn't made to feel odd because I was a woman. Said another AA, in a sense, they were all members of an exclusive club, and only they understood what dues they had had to pay to get there. On a sleeting night in 1940, a crippled Jesuit priest from St. Louis named Edward Dowling hobbled in the 24th Street clubhouse. Bill, the first to admit he was a hypochondriac, was upstairs in bed with one of his many imaginary ulcer attacks, as he called them, and he was feeling very depressed. Father Dowling, editor of a Roman Catholic publication called The Queen's Work, had read the big book and wanted to know more about Alcoholics Anonymous and its program for recovery. The stranger radiated what Bill described as grace and presence. Gradually, Bill began to unburden himself of the thoughts and guilt he had been able to confess to no one else. Father Dowling, a non-alcoholic, became his spiritual advisor and one of his staunchest supporters in an intimate friendship that endured until the priest's death 20 years later. In the spring of 1941, the Wilsons finally found stepping stones. The house, an inviting, cozy Dutch colonial, was set in a hilly, wooded area of Bedford Hills in Westchester County, about an hour's ride from New York City. The owner of the house was a woman whose husband had died an active alcoholic and whose best friend had been saved by an AA group in New Jersey. She offered the house to the Wilsons for $6,500, no money down, with mortgage payments of $40 a month. On April 11, 1941, Bill and Lois spent the first night in 23 years of marriage in a home that was truly their own. 3 years later, they saw a house named Stepping Stones in Nantucket and borrowed the name with its echoes of the 12 steps for their home. Bill's depressions were deepening. He was seldom free of black and despairing moods. He was seeing psychiatrists regularly. For a year, he took Roman Catholic instruction from Monsignor Fulton J. Sheen, a charismatic and influential New York priest whose zeal seemed to pour out of his burning, hypnotic eyes. But Bill never was converted and never was comfortable within organized religion. He and Lois spent months on the road, crisscrossing the United States to visit and inspire groups that were popping up in every region. By 1944, there were 10,000 members in 360 groups. Nell Wing, a giggly, tender-hearted woman who was Bill's non-alcoholic secretary for many years and AA's first archivist, remembered those days. I was just out of the Coast Guard and in New York to get a temporary job. A woman at the unemployment agency whispered to me, "How'd you like to work at Alcoholics Anonymous?" I went over to the AA office and there wasn't even a name on the door, just the number. There were 13 people, including Bill, jammed into three teensy little rooms. It was chaos. I remember people horsing around between answering the phones, and somebody named Mary Lou was wearing a paper bag over her head. I was hired as a typist for $32 a week, and I stayed for 36 years. The concept of anonymity was strongly rooted in AA from the beginning. So were the ideas of shunning money, property, public controversy and politics, of singleness of purpose, and of independence of local groups, with a headquarters where the staff would serve and represent those far-flung groups, but not govern them. None of this, however, had been written down. So Bill put together the 12 traditions, which, with the 12 steps, form the fundamental underpinnings of the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were never called laws, rules, or bylaws. Suggestions seemed a little weak. Traditions they became. Bill spent years pushing the 12 traditions, campaigning around the country. Sometimes the groups did not like his steamroller tactics and his constant harping upon his new set of principles. The 12 steps were a program to help heal individuals. The 12 traditions set forth a guide to group behavior, and the early, highly individualistic members balked at that. At last, however, they were approved by AA's first international convention in July 1950. By the year's end, Dr. Bob, the only other person besides Bill entitled and expected to speak for the membership, was dead of cancer. He died November 16th, and was buried in Akron's Mount Peace Cemetery beside Anne, who had died the year before. Bill was now the single individual left at the head of AA. He was 55 years old. He would live for 20 more years, would write 3 more books, the most important and popular one explaining in detail the 12 steps and 12 traditions. Before him was the 1951 Lasker Group Award given to AA, a Yale Doctorate of Laws offered in 1954 and declined with tremendous regret by Bill, who could not break the traditions he himself had written, and a proposed cover article on him in Time magazine, which he also refused. His big book had become the central textbook to guide the movement, his most important and enduring legacy. It was the foundation stone of AA's growing publishing empire and has always been a critical indicator of the numbers of people passing through AA, since it has been for sale almost entirely within AA groups or through AA headquarters, rarely in outside bookstores. The Big Book is one of the greatest publishing successes of all time. By 1985, the year of AA's 50th anniversary, 5 million copies had been sold. Royalties from Wilson's book would ultimately give him and Lois a comfortable income. By the time of his death in 1971, almost $56,000 a year. In 1986, Lois received $912,500 a year from the Big Book and 3 other AA books her husband had written. Her share had been determined by an agreement made in 1963 between Wilson and the publisher, 13.5% of the book's retail price for Lois and 1.5% for Helen W., Bill's last and most enduring mistress. Lois could not have given her fortune to AA, even if she had wished to. According to one of the 12 traditions her husband wrote, AA cannot receive any bequests at all or sums larger than $1,000 a year from a living member. Outsiders cannot give any money to AA. Even Lois was an outsider. Finally, Lois channeled some of her money into the Stepping Stones Foundation for Alcoholism Research. AA trustee Dr. John Norris said, "I was amazed, given such adoration, that Bill could retain any shred of humanity and humility. People got a thrill out of touching his coat. It was pretty heady stuff. He would sit for hours in his office, feet up, the door open, and buttonhole anybody who came along. A heavy, sloppy smoker all his life, he developed emphysema in the 1960s. He gave his last speech to the International Convention in Miami in 1970, lifted to the platform in a wheelchair, gasping for breath and sucking oxygen from the tank that was always with him. He died on January 24, 1971. Neither his headstone nor Dr. Bob's bears any mention of AA. In his final years and after his death, Bill Wilson became a cult figure within the movement, a role he both dreaded and secretly desired. He had become the Grand Poobah of AA. In 1964, Arthur Kroc, the grand old conservative columnist of the New York Times, wrote the following about President John Fitzgerald Kennedy shortly after his assassination. It could apply as well to Bill Wilson. The truth explains what the gathering myth obscures, that he was endearingly and admirably human. Chapter 4, AA Today. In 1954, Lillian Roth, the actress and nightclub singer, became the first of a long line of show business stars to confess her alcoholism and her salvation through AA. Her book, I'll Cry Tomorrow, was a sensation. The following year, Susan Hayward's screen performance as Roth brought her an Academy Award nomination. In 1956, the trustees in the House of Delegates of the American Medical Association declared that alcoholism was a disease. The nation's doctors thus validated a central concept of AA, further swelling the ranks of its membership. In 1958, the country's new but vast audience of television watchers got its first inside view of how AA worked. Days of Wine and Roses, written by J.P. Miller for Playhouse 90 and starring Cliff Robertson and Piper Laurie, was a shattering film about an attractive young couple's descent into alcoholism and the husband's redemption through AA. not since Billy Wilder and Charles Brackett made Charles R. Jackson's novel Lost Weekend into a movie in 1945 had there been such a merciless portrayal of alcoholic suffering and degradation. Lost Weekend had won 4 Oscars, including one for its star, Ray Milland. The television play Days of Wine and Roses was also a critical and public triumph. 5 years later, Jack Lemmon and Lee Remick starred in the movie version. AA collaborated on both, a first for the organization. In the last decade or so, legions of American stars, particularly in films, the theater, and television, have broken their AA anonymity in spectacular fashion. Almost all said their hope was to help other alcoholics to recover by their own example. Dennis Woley, the host of a late-night television show, wrote a book called The Courage to Change. The title came from a line in a prayer AA uses called the Serenity Prayer, which collected the testimonies of such famous recovered alcoholics as television comedian Sid Caesar and actor Jason Robards. Yet the great mass of the membership is composed of more or less ordinary people. The great drama of their lives has not been played out in squalid flophouses or behind the footlights. These drunkards have suffered forever alone, in bars or their own bedrooms or the living rooms of friends who have become increasingly estranged by their behavior. Their redemption, too, has been worked out in obscurity. To fill in the picture of this anonymous membership and how it is changing, AA headquarters has conducted a comprehensive survey every 3 years since 1968. Out of the welter of statistics, 3 important trends have emerged. 1 is that AA is no longer a male preserve. Women now form 1/3 of the total North American membership and about half of all members in big cities. The second trend, much more abrupt and dramatic, is that AA is no longer just a middle-aged society. Young people have poured in immense numbers into AA in the last 10 years. Just as dramatic and much more controversial within the ranks is that most of the young newcomers are addicted to other drugs as well as alcohol. Again, this means that AA is reflecting changes in the outside world. It is common now to hear a young speaker in AA say, "My name is Joe, and I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic." This angers some AA members, particularly the old-timers. One with 20 years of sobriety said, "This fellowship was formed to help suffering alcoholics and alcoholics only. That's why it has been so successful. We don't monkey around with other problems. I don't feel that the problems of alkies and addicts are interchangeable." In a few communities, AA members have formed over 30 groups. The message is clear, if unspoken: no druggies wanted. John T. Schwartzlose, who runs the Betty Ford Center, is infuriated by this development. "AA is the epitome of tolerance, flexibility, and inclusiveness," he said. "But some of the drug addicts who have been in here have told me about being turned away from AA meetings in the Midwest and South when they said they were just addicted to drugs. Now I tell all the addicts to say they are both alcoholics and drug abusers." In the big cities and at AA headquarters, the attitudes towards those who are labeled dually addicted are much more welcoming. About 60% of all newcomers, some still drinking at first, most not, who go to meetings for up to a year, remain in AA. Usually they stay sober for good. That means, of course, that 40% are lost to AA after trying out its program. The average member attends 4 meetings a week. After about 5 years, some AAs go to fewer and fewer meetings. They may stop altogether. This happens because veterans may feel that they have got the program and are living their lives comfortably and happily without alcohol. However, some speakers at meetings are full of cautionary tales about drifting away from AA meetings to drink again, sometimes disastrously, and for months or years before returning to the fold. AA surveys do not inquire whether members believe in God. There are no questions about ethnic or racial origins, sexual preferences, or whether alcoholism runs in the family. But one fact stands out for anyone attending meetings consistently. Often speakers begin with, "My name is Mary, and I am an alcoholic, and my father or my mother was an alcoholic." It becomes obvious after a while that the children of alcoholics become alcoholics themselves in very high numbers. Those long familiar with AA meetings also noticed that there seemed to be disproportionately high numbers of Irish Americans bred in a culture that looks benignly on its men drinking to drunkenness and doing much of their after-hour socializing in bars. For a long time, there was the belief that Jews did not become alcoholics. Jews have historically used wine sparingly, mostly for religious purposes, said Rena Rabinowitz, a former director of the JACS, Jewish Alcoholics, Chemically Dependent Persons, and Significant Others Foundation. It's no longer true. Jews are being assimilated into the American mainstream culture, and they are becoming alcoholics too. The work of JACS is helping to dispel the myth. Jews are present in large numbers at AA meetings in such cities as New York, where 15% of the population is Jewish. Sheldon B., an alcoholism counselor in New York, told how a few years ago he approached his rabbi with the idea of opening their temple to meetings of an AA group. The rabbi informed him that there was no need. There are no Jewish alcoholics. When Sheldon said, "But I am an alcoholic," the rabbi thought for a moment, then he said, "Are you sure you know who your real father was?" Hispanics are flooding into AA, both in the United States and in Latin America, but few Orientals are seen. Alcoholism has not surfaced as a significant problem in America's Oriental communities, swelled in recent years by refugees from Southeast Asia. As in the traditional Jewish culture, excessive drinking among Orientals is abhorred. In addition, the Oriental flushing reaction to alcohol is considered uncomfortable and embarrassing, as well as a built-in stopping block to drunkenness. Perhaps two-thirds to three-quarters of Orientals experience uncomfortable feelings of heat and nausea after drinking only a small amount. Blacks are seriously underrepresented in AA. There are black AA groups and mixed groups in northern cities such as Cleveland, Denver, Philadelphia, New York, and Chicago. Yet the total of blacks in AA comes nowhere near reflecting their total in the nation. Slavery didn't get the black man down, said Paul, a black doctor from Texas. Racism didn't get the black man down. But alcoholism is getting the black man down. We have a total epidemic of alcoholism and drug abuse. We also have hundreds of AA meetings in my city and only one black group. Ray B., a Wisconsin social worker, said, "The black community is afraid that if blacks admit their alcoholism, it will reinforce the white stereotype that they are shiftless, no good, and unemployable. The black community likes to think that oppression causes their alcoholism. Many gays and other oppressed minorities use the same argument. Who wouldn't drink, they say. Our lives are so goddamn awful. Society hates us. We can't get a break. Oblivion is the only way out of our pain." AA has been described as an ill-defined, loosely formed subculture of alcoholics who are no longer drinking. When you try to stretch the definition much beyond that, you get into trouble, and there are many things that outsiders believe AA to be that it is not. To begin with, it is not a temperance organization. AA does not want to save the world from gin. Nobody invites you to join. You are a member if you say you are. Or if you walk into an AA meeting with the thought that you have a drinking problem and you want to stop. Experienced persons in AA believe it is hopeless to drag another into sobriety if the alcoholic is determined not to be helped or refuses to believe he or she is ill. Even so, the courts in some states are using AA as a drunk tank, sending thousands of offenders, such as drunk drivers, to AA meetings instead of to jail, swamping meetings in states such as Maryland with hordes of resentful newcomers. By tradition, only those with a desire to stop drinking are welcome. Nonetheless, the AA program sometimes catches on with alcoholics whom the courts have forced to attend meetings. AA is not a religious cult. It is not an evangelical movement. Some members are religious, and some are agnostics or atheists. Many members choose to believe that their higher power is their AA group. On the whole, members are flexible, tolerant of eccentrics, suspicious of rules and musts. Those who have become comfortable in their sobriety often serve liquor in their homes to friends who are not alcoholic and are not upset when others drink moderately around them. AA has no ties with political parties, foundations, charities, or causes, does not sponsor research into alcoholism, does not follow up or try to control its members. Unlike most tax-exempt organizations, AA does no fundraising. Each group is self-supporting, passing a little basket at every meeting to help pay for coffee, snacks, literature, and renting space. Those present often give a dollar. Some are not able to give anything, or may drop a coin into the basket. No member may give more than $1,000 to AA in any year. No one may bequeath money to AA. No property may be given to AA, which has never owned real estate. The fear of corruption by wealth, property, power, and politics, as expressed in the 12 traditions, is as strongly rooted in AA practices today as it was more than a generation ago. The publishing operation now brings in $8.8 million annually. This is 76% of AA's yearly corporate income. It has carried the corporation since 1939.